The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning Glory America, I'm Hugh Hewitt. Ed Morrissey is here for the penultimate day of my vacation, you Steelers fans, and that includes Ed. That means second to last day. Ed Morrissey is here, and we're going to go slow for him and for all the Steelers fans. Thank you, Ed, though, for filling in for me on today's Hugh Hewitt Show.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, coming to you from the great state of Texas. Steeler fan though I am, and it's great to be back with you. Lots of great topics today, lots of great guests. We've got a great show coming up for you here today. I got to tell you though, one of the most interesting stories I think we have is that I finally found a politician who speaks for me, and this is, it's almost stunning how completely Spencer Cox, governor of Utah, managed to crystallize everything I feel about the latest CDC guidelines on masks. Look, I was masking early in this pandemic. I'm a big believer in the vaccines. I think that you should clearly take whatever steps you can to mitigate against reasonable risk with COVID-19. However, I don't think that it's incumbent on us to mitigate against the risks that other people assume. And Spencer Cox is right with us on this. It's a short clip, but it's a great clip. Let's go to clip number 6.
The CDC is asking all of you who are vaccinated to take one for the team once again to protect people who are not vaccinated, but who have the opportunity to do so. Also, I'm guessing that the Venn diagram of people who are vaccinated or unvaccinated and willing to wear a mask is very, very slim, if at all. And so I'm grateful that there are people who are willing to sacrifice and wear masks again to protect the unvaccinated. I got to be honest with you. I don't know if I'm one of those people. I'm really tired. I'm really done with it. And I'm not real excited to have to sacrifice to protect someone who doesn't seem to care.
Exactly.
Amen.
Amen, Spencer Cox. Preaching it to the world right there. Look, I mean, I and Dwayne and I have been joking around about this. I think Spencer Cox just vaulted to the top of the 2024 Republican presidential nomination.
Certainly top five.
he's up there.
Number five with a bullet.
And I mean, this is, he struck the perfect tone here. Hey, I appreciate if you're willing to do this. That's great. Really not. I'm kind of done with this. If people want to take that kind of risk, let them take that kind of risk. I have indemnified myself as far as I possibly can against that risk, and now it's time to go live our lives.
As all of you should as well.
And all of you should as well. If you're not vaccinated, go get vaccinated. If you're not vaccinated and you're not going to get vaccinated, then stay masked up until this Delta wave has crested and has started to fall, and that may be coming a little sooner than we think. We'll have a little bit more on that later in the show. But if you're not going to do either one of those two things, well, then it's all on you, baby. No one to tell you.
Not my problem.
It is gone from an MP to a YP. It's not a my problem anymore. It's a your problem. It's not even an OP. It's not even an our problem. It's your problem. And Spencer Cox, I think, hits the nail right on the head.
It's certainly not a GP, a government problem.
Well, it shouldn't be a government problem. However, we have more clips for you to explain to you who does think it's a GP. Dwayne, I mean, we got a whole bunch of this over the last 24 hours. People are still talking about this. Leading the way is his honor himself, the second worst politician in the great state of New York. Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Kaiser Wilhelm?
Yes. Second by a long gap now, as we are discovering. I mean, if you had to tell me at the beginning of last year that I would think that Bill de Blasio is not the worst politician in New York, I would have been stunned Of course, we know that that's the case, but he's still trying. He's number two and trying harder, Dwayne.
Yes.
Let's listen to Bill de Blasio in cut number three.
Right now, we have to fight COVID like never before. The Delta variant has changed the game. Unless we want to run the risk of going back to restrictions and having our freedom taken away and people losing their jobs again, it's really clear what we have to do. People have to get vaccinated. And we had a long period where it was voluntary, there was incentives, it was compassionate and kind. But now it's time to get a little blunter about the fact that everyone needs to get vaccinated for the good of their family, their community, their country. And a lot of people, I think, are close to that point, but they needed a little more of a push. So here's a clear message. We're saying you want to go and enjoy great restaurants. Amen. You want to go to movie theaters, go to the gym. That's great. We want all that. You got to get vaccinated. You want to work in those places? You got to get vaccinated for the good and the health of everyone around you as well. It's not that tough to do. We say just get the first vaccination and you're in. Come back later, obviously, get that second one when it's time. Now, here's the bottom line. We've heard from lots of folks in the business community. They said, amen. They said, this is really helpful because it makes the rules clear. And it's the way to stop COVID once and for all. Joe Biden said clearly he'd like to see more people do this. I'm urging mayors, governors, county executives, just do it, because this is how we're going to get that final push of vaccination we need to end the COVID era once and for all. And bluntly, Willie, I think if you're doing the right thing by everyone else around you and getting vaccinated, then you should enjoy everything in life. But if you are not getting vaccinated, then you're not going to be able to do some of the things you love. And our young people in particular, I guarantee, as the father of two 20-somethings, young people don't want to be left out of restaurants, bars, concerts. This is the kind of thing that's going to inspire a lot of young people to just get out there and get vaccinated.
So who did he just say can't be part of New York society?
The unvaccinated.
Which a large part is who again?
Well, it's a fairly broad spectrum of
yes,
people.
It is.
But in New York, I mean, how many deep red Southern conservatives are there in New York? I mean, just
four.
Four maybe, right? So, I mean, it's not really a big issue here. Where they're having problems getting traction are in some of the minority communities. And because there is a certain level of mistrust of government intervention in those communities. So Bill de Blasio is basically...
He's asking for people in the minority community to prove that they're vaccinated. They have to show some sort of proof that they're vaccinated.
That's what a vaccine passport means, man. That's what a vaccine passport means.
Here's my proof. See, it says who I am.
And if that's the case, then great. But those CDC cards were never intended for that purpose. They weren't even created for that purpose.
So how do we make sure that that says I'm who I am?
You need another form of ID to say, oh, no. By the way, let me match this up. And so, you know, all those people who couldn't go to Kinko's, wasn't that the argument?
Yes.
People don't know how to go to Kinko's.
So
to get
you're
an
telling
ID.
Me that Bill de Blasio is asking minorities in New York to show ID to be able to take part in New York society?
Is that what he's saying? Not just that. But you need to be able to show ID so that your families aren't separated. Let's go to the other clip with Bill de Blasio.
Yeah, listen very closely to this cut.
Very short, but it's important.
Very close. Cut four.
We welcome kids, of course, to restaurants and movie theaters, et cetera. Wear a mask. That's a smart thing to do. And hopefully soon our 5 to 11-year-olds will be eligible for vaccination on top of that. But we don't want to separate families. We want families to enjoy stuff together, but in a safe
environment.
Wait, stop.
Hold.
I thought separating families was bad. I mean, why is he even bringing that up? Who's talking about separating families?
Who asked to separate families? You have to go into a restaurant and say the smoking and non-smoking section. It's now the vaccinated and unvaccinated section.
I don't even know where to begin with this. Nobody's even suggesting this as an issue. First off, children that young are simply not vectors for this disease. Not even in the Delta wave. There is some concern about teenagers, but people, you know, kids 5 to 12, aren't vectors for this disease. This is the nonsense that you get. There's two factors going into this. One is authoritarianism, which this pandemic has just unleashed. And the second is this nonsense about we need to regulate down down to zero risk. There is no such thing as zero risk. There's no such thing as zero risk in life.
Never will be.
You can't regulate risk out of your choices. And that risk is something that people have to make decisions on. And if government's trying to indemnify against the risky choices that people are making by not getting vaccinated, by forcing everybody else to bend around that, then you're eliminating at least some of the incentive to go out and get vaccinated.
We don't want to have to separate your families.
This is nonsense.
De Blasio's basically saying it's a nice family you have. Shame something happened to it.
And bear in mind, with all this that we just said, Bill de Blasio is still only the second worst politician in the great state of New York. Later on in the show, we'll probably get to the first worst politician in the great state of New York. So stay tuned for that. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Hugh Hewitt. We'll be right back. Good morning, Hugh Hewitt fans. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Hugh today and tomorrow. And having a blast doing it. Look, we just finished up talking about Ron DeSantis, and we're going to move on to another topic here in just a moment. But I got to give you just one last little quick thing about this. I said in the last segment that Democrats are going to demagogue on DeSantis, and they're going to do it hoping that the media is going to go along with him. And as soon as I went to break, I went over and looked at the Twitter stream, and here's CNN describing Ron DeSantis. DeSantis, who is expected to be a top contender in the next GOP presidential primary if Trump doesn't run, is weaponizing his stewardship of the emergency to further his own political aspirations. He's weaponizing it. This is an analysis by Stephen Collinson at CNN. And I'm just curious, did anybody at CNN ever describe Andrew Cuomo as weaponizing his stewardship of the pandemic when he was getting $5 million for a book, you know, patting himself on the back for killing thousands of seniors? I'm just curious about
this. I'm sure Chris Cuomo covered that on his show last night. I'm sure
that
happened.
Oh, yes, I'm sure. I am absolutely certain that's exactly what happened, Dwayne. At least CNN, they're pitching in for Chuck Schumer on targeting DeSantis. This is going to be a very interesting cycle here. I mean, this is and our good friend Chuck Todd, who I like Chuck Todd, but his claim was a couple of weeks ago that there's no such thing as liberal media bias is absolute nonsense. Absolute nonsense. Nevertheless, we want to move on to a brand new topic. Our friend Hugh Hewitt is on vacation, but he was actually on a working vacation last night because he hosted a debate between the various challengers to Gavin Newsom in California's gubernatorial recall election. A number of people were on stage, none of whom were named Jane Fonda, Dwayne. I'm actually a little surprised that Jane Fonda didn't accept the invitation.
Yes, the 142-year-old Viet Cong candidate was not on the stage last night.
Did you see the San Francisco Chronicle article
Yes.
that Jane Fonda was considering jumping into the race because she was worried that Gavin Newsom wasn't going to be able to defeat the recall?
But that's the thing about the Democratic Party is they're kind of putting all their eggs in the Gavin Newsom basket, right? You know, if he goes down, there's really not a lot of Democrats that are kind of running as that's a hard campaign to run.
You right.
Know, how do say, you do say, it? Say no to the recall. But if you do, vote for me instead.
Yeah, I mean, it's really an untenable. You got some low-level Democrats that are running in this because they need some name recognition for later on down the road, or they're looking at Newsom and figuring he's vulnerable, and there should be some Democrats in the mix.
But
there's no high-level
Democrat statewide that is trying to seize the opportunity and saying, yeah, let's toss him overboard, but let's hang on to the state. There's really nobody high-profile making that case.
Well, in that case, Jane Fonda should have jumped in. I mean, she's only 83 years old. That's still younger than Jerry Brown was in his last term, right?
Younger than Dianne Feinstein.
So, yeah, I mean, that was a little amusing thing. But no, Jane Fonda wasn't on the stage last night. Hugh would have loved that, actually. But this debate that was carried by 13 Fox affiliates all around the great state of California, and Hugh promised to run an efficient and respectful debate. And I didn't see it, but Dwayne, you did. And how did it turn out?
It was as advertised. They really didn't attack each other much. They pretty much kept their focus on on Gavin Newsom, and they were all asked very smart, intelligent questions. You know, things like, so if you were governor, knowing that it is pretty hostile environment against you with a super legislature against you, what do you think you could get done realistically? A fair question. All four of them got a bite at the apple. What would you do different than Gavin Newsom on COVID and mandates? Fair question. Let's hear what they would all do. That's the kind of stuff you got from this debate. Was it a Donald Trump hammer throw? No, but it was actually substantive, which kind of surprises you in debates these days.
Well, let's take a listen to this. We're going to get through a few of these cuts here. Let's take the first question. What would these candidates do as governor? Let's go to John Cox first on that question.
The first thing that I do as the governor of this state is I call a special session to address housing. The housing crisis is the most severe problem. We have a lot of them, but housing really is the most severe because it's driving businesses out of the state. It's driving people out of the state. Housing is my business. I build houses in other states for a tiny fraction of what it costs to do in California. And the problem is government. It's government mandates. It's government lawsuits occasioned by the California Environmental Quality Act. It's all the delays. It's all the approval processes. I can get approvals in Indiana in 6 to 12 months. It takes 12 years. And the problem with the cost of housing is it drives the middle class into poverty and out of this state. And it also drives up the cost of everything else. Think about it. It's a wage price spiral upwards. I'm a CPA, I'm a businessman. I understand what families are going through, and we need to tackle housing. I'm also going to tackle the other problems in this legislature. I'm going to try to do it with the legislators' help, but if I don't get that help, I'm going to go in the districts and try to get people elected who will fix the problems of this state.
All right, so you heard the ding. That was the end of that one. Let's go to Kevin Falconer in the Nixon Library debate.
Just say at the outset, first and foremost, I'm excited. I'm excited because this recall is happening, and Californians are ready to make a change at the top. And I'm ready to bring California together to champion the reforms and the changes that this state so desperately needs. Standing up for public safety and making our neighborhoods safer. Removing tent encampments from our sidewalks and making California more affordable. I'm looking forward to bringing our state together after a very difficult time to do that. And I have experience doing that. I did that as mayor of San Diego after a very difficult time in our city's history. I'm going to take that exact same approach. And I have experience in working with a majority Democrat legislature because I did it my entire tenure as mayor of San Diego. What do? You go out and you win the argument publicly. And then when you win the argument, you can get the vote. And I'm going to focus first and foremost on making California affordable. I put forward the largest tax cut in California history for our middle class because we need it, because our state's too expensive and Californians are leaving and voting with their feet. So if you believe like I do that it's time to make California more affordable, we can do it.
Once again, the ding hits and the time was up. Kevin Kiley is next. Let's listen to Kevin Kiley's response to this question.
That's right, and I have authored some of the most groundbreaking legislation to pass in recent years on topics like school choice, public safety, criminal justice reform, artificial intelligence. But what I've also seen in my 5 years in the legislature is that our state government is fundamentally broken. That's why our quality of life is declining in California. And what's broken it is we have a political class that serves special interests rather than serving the people of California. And I have not been able to fix our broken state government as one member of the legislature, and I wouldn't be able to do it on my own as governor, but I would be able to start doing it on day one with the mandate for fundamental change that this recall would provide. So the question you ask is the right one, because whoever wins this race is going to have 1 year to offer a viable alternative and set our state on a new course before the next election. So I'd say, first of all, the era of corruption is over. I've already taken a step in this direction by becoming the first elected official in California not to accept any funding from such special interests. Second, I'd strategically use executive authority to unwind harmful policies, such as by finally terminating the state of emergency and making sure that every California school is open full time. But yes, to truly get fundamental change, you need to work with the legislature. And having spent 5 years in the legislature, I know that the one thing legislators respond to is political pressure, the fear of losing their job. And having just seen the governor lose his job, there will be a unique opportunity to bring fundamental reforms on issues like the cost of living, rising crime rates, and school choice.
And time is up on Kevin Kiley. We're going to come back to Doug Ose in the next segment on this question. It's a great question to ask. And I'm kind of struck here about how these candidates are sort of addressing these issues. I think Kevin Kiley, at least so far, and we haven't heard from Doug Ose, we will in the next segment. I think only Kevin Kiley really is addressing the issue that is driving the recall, which is Gavin Newsom's management of the COVID-19 pandemic through emergency orders. And I know that they're going to, in another question that they were asked about COVID-19, what would they do about COVID-19? But I'm struck by the fact that at least out of the first three that we've listened to here, Kevin Kiley may have been the only one who actually put his finger on why the opening might exist for him to get 1 year in as governor. And that would be it before he'd have to stand for election again. When we come back, more from Doug Ose. I'm Ed Morrissey from HotAir.com, filling in for Hugh. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com. Moving on up to guest host for Hugh Hewitt today and tomorrow, and talking a little bit about the moratorium on evictions. And the Washington Post editorial board came out and said, golly, we think this might be illegal. Golly, you think? Joining us to discuss this is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, author of The Case for Nationalism, at Rich Lowry on Twitter. Rich, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, it's not going so well. I'm not sure what it means when the Washington Post editorial board agrees with me. Of course, they're also agreeing with objective reality, Rich, which apparently is escaping the White House and some of the Democrats here with this eviction moratorium. This is it's one thing to say, look, I think that we have legitimate authority to do this. It's another thing to say, yeah, we know that this is illegal. We're going to do it anyway. I mean, how do you even justify something like that when your oath of office requires you to uphold and defend the Constitution?
Yeah. I mean, he's admitting that he is affirmatively violating his sworn duty to uphold the Constitution. And I give the Washington Post credit. At least one of his allies is criticizing this, but the rest are just pocketing the gain. At the same time, they say, you know, the Texas voting law, because there's no longer be drive-through voting, is authoritarianism and a violation of our democracy. At the same time, you know, every Tucker Carlson monologue is supposedly Democratic backsliding. And here you have the President of the United States defying our constitutional order, trampling on the prerogatives of Congress, and basically violating what, in effect, was the verdict of the people's representatives. Because Nancy Pelosi tried to pass this extension through the House. 12 House Democrats or so said no, and that's why it didn't happen. So that's democracy. Those are our representatives. They've spoken. And for the president just to go and defy the will of the people's representatives is totally outrageous, and it just tells you everything you need to know, that people like Greg Sargent and Jonathan Chait are always going on about the threat of authoritarianism. As far as I can tell, haven't said a cross word about this. They don't care about a president violating our Constitution.
Well, at least the newspaper that says democracy dies in darkness managed to cover the news this time. This is part of this whole hysteria from the previous 4 years of how democracy was on a knife's edge because Donald Trump was president. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of Donald Trump, but if this had happened, if Donald Trump had done this precise series of events, they would have been screaming out loud. In fact, they were screaming out loud about Donald Trump redirecting funds that had already been appropriated to the Department of Defense for building the border wall, right? I mean, and they were talking about that as being authoritarian and undermining the rule of law. This, that wasn't even illegal. I mean, courts ruled on that.
At least a colorable, even if you take a hostile view of that, at least a colorable legal case. And what I said, I thought that violated the spirit of the law. I didn't know whether it necessarily was illegal.
I actually agree with
itself,
that.
But you had 10 Senate Republicans or so voting against it on that basis, where you have Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. And this is where James Madison would just be completely confounded, because he thought each branch would be jealous of its power. Instead, here you have Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer spent their entire careers climbing to the apex of the legislative branch that's supposed to pass the laws. When they can't pass the laws, they urge the president to violate the constitutional order and trample on Congress to get done what they want to get done. And that's Madison just would his jaw would be open. He just wouldn't know how to process that.
I think that if you go back and look at some of the arguments in the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalists, I think that you see hints of this in their deep suspicion of political parties, right? Because I think that they were concerned about the interests of the political parties trumping what are the natural interests, the natural constitutional interests of each of the branches. And I think it maybe took 200 years or so for us to get to this point. But you know, certainly the 17th Amendment had something to do with this, Rich, where we made the Senate a direct election rather than appointments through state legislatures, or at least mandated that they be directly elected at that point, at which point they became just another party office to be claimed. And I think as the two parties have moved from at least some regional interests into almost completely now ideological coalitions, that we're seeing the fruition of this, where there really isn't any true tension between two different branches of the federal government if the same party holds both of those branches.
Yeah,
and that's true with Republicans,
really
too.
Those are all really good points. I think another thing that's playing in here is the pervasive view, it's kind of become conventional wisdom, and we all fall prey to this, that the Supreme Court decides. And that's sort of what Joe Biden is saying. Oh, the Constitution, I don't have anything to do with the Constitution. We'll just throw this out here. I think it's probably illegal. It'll probably be struck down by the courts. We'll let the courts deal with it. That's not the way it's supposed to work. Every elected official, all of us, have an obligation to uphold the Constitution. It's supposed to be much broader than just one branch of government, but we've moved away from that view.
And Rich, I mean, to specific now more to the eviction moratorium here, this is probably not a very good policy that still really needs to have some sort of a rational wind down. I mean, you can't just let this thing collapse. And because bad policy has its own consequences, you have to deal with the consequences of bad policy. And I'll give the previous Congress, some grace on this, because they're facing an unprecedented pandemic with unprecedented consequences. They were trying to find ways to deal with this. And without making sure, without having people, millions of people suddenly have to be transiting between different places to find housing. And that made some sense, even if it was probably overall not terribly advisable to do it in the way they did it. At this point, Congress needs to have some sort of a rational wind down, some sort of an off ramp for this. And Congress had 32 days. I mean, you know, Justice Kavanaugh stayed a decision. It wasn't a decision, but he stayed a lower court decision on this for 32 days to allow Congress to do that, right? They said, well, this is not, we can't have this moratorium. It's not constitutional, but I'm going to give Congress an extra month here to do something rational with this. At which point Congress immediately jumped on this. Well, that's not true. It took Congress 30 days to even start to address this. So you made the mention of this. And again, we're speaking with Rich Lowry of NationalReview.com, author of The Case for Nationalism, at Rich Lowry on Twitter. They waited 30 days to get to this. And the reason why they didn't have anything to put on the floor is because nobody had done any of the work. The White House hadn't done any of the work. House Democrats hadn't done any of the work. Nobody had been talking about this until I believe it was either Maxine Waters or Cori Bush, cornered Nancy Pelosi on the floor of the House and told her that they needed to do something about this. This is a failure of leadership in both Congress and the White House. That's the reason why we're in this position.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think you can argue with Kavanaugh, because there are four conservatives who said, you know what, it's unconstitutional. We're going to uphold this lower court stay, and it should just end, and then let everyone else figure it out. And Kavanaugh's, no, let's give Congress more time, and I think the four others are probably correct. But anyway, he gives
right,
us more
I agree.
Additional time, and yeah, they do nothing with it. And even if they had moved on this more expeditiously, it sounds as though there just wasn't support, because there were a dozen Democrats or so who thought it was bad policy. And even if you think people still need rent support, this isn't the way to go about it, because it really screws the landlords. What you want to do is put money in the hands of the renters and have them pay their landlords, or at least do support the landlords. My understanding, I think Pelosi mentioned this on the House floor, they passed a program, I don't know, $30 billion or something. I might be making up the numbers. But almost none of the money went out the door, which also is a classic Washington thing. You know,
yep.
The big so-called COVID relief bill earlier this year, how much of that has been spent, right? They're using a lot of it for the bipartisan infrastructure deal, because it's just sitting there, because they just were firing money out of a cannon without any regard to what was actually happening with it.
And I think actually you undershot that. It was $49 billion that has been appropriated through the three different COVID relief bills, only $3 billion of which has been spent.
Yeah.
And Nancy Pelosi and the White House are pointing fingers at the governors for not moving this money around. But, you know, the governors have to comply with the rules and regulations attached to this. At the Department of Treasury, Janet Yellen is saying, well, you know, look, I mean, Congress could expedite this by providing a little bit more structure. It's a mess, and it's a mess that Democrats have created, and it's a mess that Democrats are now trying to punt to each other. You've got Nancy Pelosi trying to punt it to the CDC and to the Biden White House. Biden initially was saying, well, it's the governors and it's Congress, and then he kind of backtracked on this. I mean, this may be worse than not doing anything, in that it's creating all this uncertainty around the rental markets, and investors are paying attention to this. And if the goal here is to get more affordable housing to people who need it, this is exactly the way you don't go about this. Right, Rich?
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is these kind of heroic interventions, as you mentioned earlier, you know, March, April 2020, you can understand it. You know,
yep.
We're on the cusp of this crisis. We're shutting down most of the country. But we're coming out of that now, and we're experiencing robust growth. And it's time for this stuff to end. And we've seen that with the enhanced unemployment benefits. You know, there's an argument about how much of an effect they have, but certainly at the margins, they make it less likely for people to go out and get employed, which is like really important at all levels. It's important economically, it's important psychologically, it's important for future people's future skills and earning power. So this is a whole other topic, obviously, but we're returning to normal, right? I mean, the Delta cases are spiking, but we're in a totally different situation than we were a year and a half ago, because 70% of the country, 70% of adults have at least one shot. And we just
Indeed.
Have no vocabulary or no way of absorbing that.
Rich Lowry from NationalReview.com. Thanks for being with us. At Rich Lowry on Twitter. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Hugh Hewitt. We'll be right back.
Thank you, Ed Morrissey. I'm not there today, of course, but I want to keep reminding people about the amazing sponsors. I'm lying on a beach. That's where I am, and Ed is filling in for me so ably, and I appreciate that. I hope he's not pummeling you with Steelers talk. Poor old Big Ben showed up looking puffy. But he got his house. He doesn't have to worry. He's just going to mail it in for a year. But if you need a house, if you want to buy a house, say you moved from Minnesota to, say, Texas, and you had to buy a house, call Andrew and Todd first. Andrew Del Rey, Todd Avakian are great sponsors of the program. AndrewandTodd.com with Sierra Pacific. They lend money. Get pre-qualified. You call them at 888-888-1172. Find out how much you can afford. Have them help you fix your credit report so you can afford more. House prices are on the rise. That means you're going to need more eligibility. And the way to do that, of course, call AndrewandTodd.com. Head to their website at AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172. And don't forget, ReliefFactor.com. I took it in the first part of the day. As soon as I got up on vacation, I take it with me on vacation. The Fetching Mrs. Hewitt has it packed away. Don't leave home without it, and certainly don't go to work this morning. Maybe you have a Texas commute like Ed does, stretching vast in front of you. Endless plains stretching, rolling out with oil wells and tumbleweeds. ReliefFactor.com. Maybe you're in wintry Minnesota and you're listening. It's winter there already. That's why Ed left. Get your ReliefFactor.com. If you're on the beaches of California or sweltering in D.C., take your ReliefFactor.com. Don't forget it. Don't leave home without it. I take it in the first hour, remind you about it hour two and three. Whether you're working out more, getting into shape, or whether you are just getting a little bit older and a little bit more pain because your joints hurt, relieffactor.com. Please don't forget it. Go there, $19.95, get you started, relieffactor.com. Come right back for more of Ed Morrissey on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Hugh Hewitt today. It's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Michael Oren, former Israeli Deputy Prime Minister for Diplomacy and former Ambassador to the U.S., and at Dr. Michael Oren on Twitter, and along with a lot of other things, actually an excellent film critic. Dr. Oren, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Ed.
I just got done reading a terrific critique of a new television series in Israel called The Beauty Queen of Jerusalem. And I think you missed your calling. This is an excellent essay here.
People don't know this. I have a whole Hollywood connection. I used to be Orson Welles' assistant. That's the weirdest thing going. No kidding.
I had no idea.
So it was a thing. I had to make a decision at an early age whether to stay in Hollywood or go into the Israeli paratroopers. And I figured going to the paratroopers, I could always go back to Hollywood. And I ended up staying. But yes, I have a particular interest in the interface between film, television programs, movies, politics, and the state of Israel. And so this is one of a series of reviews I've made over the course of, say, the last year. Just before this, I reviewed an extraordinary Australian series called A Place to Call Home, which is the most pro-Jewish, the most pro-Israel, and the most pro-religion series I've seen in years.
Well, that's interesting. You can't say that about The Beauty Queen of Jerusalem, unfortunately. And no, I mean, I'm not reading through this, and you write so eloquently about this. And Dr. Oren, I mean, I it's almost to me like the 1619 Project of Israel. I mean, this is something that completely changes the origin story of your country in ways that that undercut it and do so dishonestly. I mean, you know, every country has its good issues and bad issues, I guess you could say. I mean, nobody's perfect. But, I mean, in this case, it really mischaracterizes what was going on in the time period that it's taking place, which was between the Ottoman Empire and the founding of the State of Israel. And it does so in a way that really undercuts the whole reason for Israel's existence. And I found it extraordinary, as you're writing about this, I found it extraordinary that Israel actually has a Hollywood. I didn't know this.
No, Israel has a blooming Hollywood. I mean, the hit shows on American television, everything from Homeland to In Treatment to now Fauda, Tehran. These are all Israeli programs, and all the major studios have opened up offices here because everyone's hungry for content.
Right.
And I'm sure that this program, A Beauty Queen of Jerusalem, this series will make it onto American television, but it's going to give a profoundly distorted view of Israel's history, and it's a review that comes right out of the extreme Israeli left, which says that, you know, the reason we have a conflict with the Palestinians is because the outcome of the 1948 war and the 1967 war. So it's about expulsion of Palestinians, about acquisition of Palestinian territory, capture of Palestinian territory by the Israeli army, and it's not a religious conflict. It's not a conflict that began 1948. Had nothing to do with the Holocaust. The British were great. They were terrific when they were here. These are all sort of left-wing tropes here. But they're wrong. And what history shows us was that the Palestinian-Arab attempt to destroy the Zionist project began 28 years before the state was formed in 1920, that it was all around religion, about radical Islam and false claims that the Jews were trying to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and that the British officials were anti-Semitic. And Britain bore the responsibility for closing Palestine's door to the Jews of Europe, condemning them to death in the Holocaust in 1939. It's quite extraordinary. I watched this series with my mouth hanging open, not for good reason.
Yeah, when I said Hollywood, that you have a Hollywood in Israel, I didn't mean it as an industry. I meant it more as a political point of view.
I get it. Now I understand it. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I feel for you because we've had it here for a very long time, and I'm sorry to see it showing up in Israel in this fashion. And it'd be one thing if this was entertaining, and you're also saying at the same time, it really isn't. It's not very well done on any level here, except for maybe cinematography. Maybe that's the only thing that's
It's not a good series. It's just not a good series. There are some very good series that are just as bad. Watch Our Boys on HBO. Which the Israeli government has called an anti-Semitic series.
Right.
Which is just horrible. And if you watch another series on Netflix called The Messiah, which is not an Israeli series, but it manages to touch every single anti-Semitic trope. Amazing.
It's amazing that this continues on. And I know that, we only had a short time, but I really want to highlight this. It's at tabletmag.com. It just came up yesterday. The Beauty Queen of The Beauty Queen of Jerusalem by Michael Oren. Make sure you read this. This is a really, I think, damaging way to look at this. If it gets to American shores, we should be inoculated against it. And Dr. Michael Oren has given us that inoculation. Thank you very much, Dr. Oren, for being with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com filling in for you.